Resuming our recording of A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce. A great fire, banked high and red, flamed in the grate, and under the ivy-twined branches of the chandelier the Christmas table was spread. They had come home a little late, and still dinner was not ready, but it would be ready in a jiffy, his mother had said. They were waiting for the door to open and for the servants to come in, holding the big dishes covered with their heavy metal covers. All were waiting. Uncle Charles, who sat far away in the shadow of the window, Dante and Mr. Casey, who sat in the easy chairs at either side of the hearth, Stephen, seated on a chair between them, his feet resting on the toasted boss. Mr. Dedalus looked at himself in the pier glass above the mantelpiece, waxed out his moustache ends, and then, parting his coat tails, stood with his back to the glowing fire, and still from time to time he withdrew a hand from his coat tail to wax out one of his moustache ends. Mr. Casey leaned his head to one side and, smiling, tapped the gland on his neck with his fingers. And Stephen smiled too, for he knew that it was not true that Mr. Casey had a purse of silver in his throat. He smiled to think how the silvery noise with which Mr. Casey used to make had deceived him. And when he had tried to open Mr. Casey's hand to see if the purse of silver was hidden there, he had seen that the fingers could not be straightened out. And Mr. Casey had told him that he had got those three cramped fingers making a birthday present for Queen Victoria. Mr. Casey tapped the gland of his neck and smiled at Stephen with sleepy eyes, and Mr. Dedalus said to him, "Yes, well, no, that's all right. Oh, we had a good walk, hadn't we, John? Yes. I wonder if there's any likelihood of dinner this evening? Yes. Oh, well, no, we got a good breath of ozone round ahead today, aye, aye, bedad." He turned to Dante and said, "You didn't stir out at all, Mrs. Reardon." Dante frowned and said shortly, "No." Mr. Dedalus dropped his coat tails and went over to the sideboard. He brought forth a great stone jar of whiskey from the locker and filled the decanter slowly, bending now and then to see how much he had poured in. Then, replacing the jar in the locker, he poured a little of the whiskey into two glasses, added a little water, and came back with them to the fireplace. "A thimbleful, John," he said, "just to whet your appetite." Mr. Casey took the glass, drank, and placed it near him on the mantelpiece. Then he said, "Well, I can't help thinking of our friend Christopher manufacturing." He broke into a fit of laughter and coughing and added, "Manufacturing that champagne for those fellows." Mr. Dedalus laughed loudly. "Is it Christy?" he said. "There's more cunning in one of those warts on his bald head than in a pack of Jack Foxes." He inclined his head, closed his eyes, and, licking his lips profusely, began to speak with the voice of the hotel keeper. "And he has such a soft mouth when he's speaking to you, don't you know? He's very moist and watery about the dewlaps, God bless him." Mr. Casey was still struggling through his fit of coughing and laughter. Stephen, seeing and hearing the hotel keeper through his father's face and voice, laughed. Mr. Dedalus put up his eyeglass and, staring down at him, said quietly and kindly, "What are you laughing at, you little puppy, you?" The servants entered and placed the dishes on the table. Mrs. Dedalus followed and the places were arranged. "Sit over," she said. Mr. Dedalus went to the end of the table and said, "Now, Mrs. Reardon, sit over. John, sit you down, my hearty." He looked round to where Uncle Charles sat and said, "Now then, sir, there's a bird here waiting for you." When all had taken their seats, he laid his hand on the cover and then said quickly, withdrawing it, "Now, Stephen." Stephen stood up in his place to say the grace before meals. "Bless us, O Lord, in these thy gifts which through thy bounty we are about to receive through Christ our Lord. Amen." All blessed themselves, and Mr. Dedalus, with a sigh of pleasure, lifted from the dish the heavy cover pearled around the edge with glistening drops. Stephen looked at the plump turkey which had lain trussed and skewered on the kitchen table. He knew that his father had paid a guinea for it at Dunn's of Delir Street, and that the man had prodded it often at the breastbone to show how good it was, and he remembered the man's voice when he had said, "Take that one, sir. That's the real Ali Dali." Why did Mr. Barrett in Clongowes call his pandybat a turkey? But Clongowes was far away, and the warm, heavy smell of turkey and ham and celery rose from the plates and dishes, and the great fire was banked high and red in the grate, and the green ivy and red holly made you feel so happy, and when dinner was ended, the big plump pudding would be carried in, studded with peeled almonds and sprigs of holly, with bluish fire running round it, and a little green flag flying from the top. It was his first Christmas dinner, and he thought of his little brothers and sisters, who were waiting in the nursery, as he had often waited, till the pudding came. The deep low collar and the Eton jacket made him feel queer and oldish, and that morning when his mother had brought him down to the parlour dressed for Mass, his father had cried. That was because he was thinking of his own father, and Uncle Charles had said so too. Mr. Dedalus covered the dish and began to eat hungrily. Then he said, "Poor old Christy, he's nearly lopsided now with roguery." "Simon," said Mrs. Dedalus, "you haven't given Mrs. Reardon any sauce." Mr. Dedalus seized the sauceboat. "Haven't I?" he cried. "Mrs. Reardon, pity the poor blind." Dante covered her plate with her hands and said, "No thanks." Mr. Dedalus turned to Uncle Charles. "How are you off, sir?"
"Right as the mail, Simon."
"You, John?"
"I'm all right. Go on yourself."
"Mary, here, Stephen, here's something to make your hair curl." He poured sauce freely over Stephen's plate and set the boat again on the table. Then he asked Uncle Charles, was it tender? Uncle Charles could not speak because his mouth was full, but he nodded that it was. "That was a good answer our friend made to the cannon." "What?" said Mr. Dedalus.
"I didn't think he had that much in him," said Mr. Casey.
"I'll pay you your dues, father, when you cease turning the house of God into a polling booth."
"A nice answer," said Dante, "for any man calling himself a Catholic to give to his priest."
"Should they have only themselves to blame," said Mr. Dedalus suavely. "If they took a fool's advice, they would confine their attention to religion."
"It is religion," Dante said. "They are doing their duty to warn the people."
"We go to the house of God," Mr. Casey said, "in all humility to pray to our Maker and not to hear election addresses."
"It is religion," Dante said again. "They are right. They must direct their flocks."
"And preach politics from the altar, is it?" asked Mr. Dedalus.
"Certainly," said Dante. "It is a question of public morality. A priest would not be a priest if he did not tell his flock what is right and what is wrong."
Mrs. Dedalus laid down her knife and fork, saying, "For pity's sake, and for pity's sake, let us have no political discussion on this day of all days of the year."
"Quite right, ma'am," said Uncle Charles. "Now, Simon, that's quite enough now. Not another word now."
"Yes, yes," said Mr. Dedalus quickly. He uncovered the dish boldly and said, "Now then, who's for more turkey?" Nobody answered. Dante said, "Nice language for any Catholic to use."
"Mrs. Reardon, I appeal to you," said Mrs. Dedalus, "to let the matter drop now."
Dante turned on her and said, "And am I to sit here and listen to the pastors of my church being flouted?"
"Nobody is saying a word against them," said Mr. Dedalus, "so long as they don't meddle in politics."
"The bishops and priests of Ireland have spoken," said Dante, "and they must be obeyed."
"Let them leave politics alone," said Mr. Casey, "or the people may leave their church alone."
"You hear?" said Dante, turning to Mrs. Dedalus.
"Mr. Casey, Simon," said Mrs. Dedalus, "let it end now."
"Too bad, too bad," said Uncle Charles.
"What?" cried Mr. Dedalus. "Were we to desert him at the bidding of the English people?"
"He was no longer worthy to lead," said Dante. "He was a public sinner."
"We are all sinners and black sinners," said Mr. Casey coldly.
"Woe be to the man by whom the scandal cometh," said Mrs. Reardon. "It would be better for him than a millstone were tied about his neck and that he were cast into the depth of the sea, rather than he should scandalize one of these my least little ones. That is the language of the Holy Ghost."
"And very bad language, if you ask me," said Mr. Dedalus coolly.
"Simon, Simon," said Uncle Charles, "the boy."
"Yes, yes," said Mr. Dedalus. I was thinking about the bad language of that railway porter.
Well, now, that's all right. Here, Stephen, show me your plate, old chap. Eat away now. Here."
He heaped up the food on Stephen's plate and served Uncle Charles and Mr. Casey to large pieces of turkey and splashes of sauce. Mrs. Dedalus was eating little, and Dante sat with her hands in her lap. She was red in the face. Mr. Dedalus rooted with the carvers at the end of the dish and said, "There's a tasty bit here we call the Pope's nose, if any lady or gentleman." He held a piece of fowl up on the prong of the carving fork. Carving fork. Nobody spoke. He put it on his own plate, saying, "Well, you can't say but you were asked. I think I'd better eat it myself, because I'm not well in my health lately." He winked at Stephen and, replacing the dish cover, began to eat again. There was a silence while he ate. Then he said, "Well, now, the day kept up fine after all. There were plenty of strangers down, too." Nobody spoke. He said again, "I think there were more strangers down than last Christmas." He looked round at the others, whose faces were bent towards their plates, and, receiving no reply, waited for a moment and said bitterly, "Well, my Christmas dinner has been spoiled anyhow." "There could be neither luck nor grace," Dante said, "in a house where there is no respect for the pastors of the church." Mr. Dedalus threw his knife and fork noisily on his plate. "Respect," he said, "is it for Billy with the lip or the tub of guts up in Ramah? Respect!"
"Princes of the church," said Mr. Casey with slow scorn.
"Lord Leitrim's coachman, yes," said Mr. Dedalus. "They are the Lord's anointed," Dante said. "They are an honour to their country."
"Tub of guts," said Mr. Dedalus coarsely. "He has a handsome face, mind you, in repose.
You should see that fellow lapping up his bacon and cabbage of a cold winter's day. Oh, Johnny!"
He twisted his features into a grimace of heavy bestiality and made a lapping noise with his lips.
"Really, Simon," said Mrs. Dedalus, "you should not speak that way before Stephen. It's not right."
"Oh, he'll remember all this when he grows up," said Dante hotly. "The language he heard against God and religion and priests in his own home."
"Let him remember too," cried Mr. Casey to her from across the table, "the language with which the priests and the priests' pawns broke Parnell's heart and hounded him to his grave. Let him remember that too when he grows up."
"Sons of bitches," cried Mr. Dedalus, "when he was down they turned on him to betray him and rend him like rats in a sewer. Low living dogs, and they look it. By Christ, they look it."
"They behaved rightly," cried Dante. "They obeyed their bishops and their priests. Honour to them."
"Well, it is perfectly dreadful to say that not even for one day in the year," said Mrs. Dedalus, "can we be free from these dreadful disputes."
Uncle Charles raised his hands mildly and said, "Come now, come now, come now. Can we not have our opinions, whatever they are, without this bad temper and this bad language? It is too bad, surely." Mrs. Dedalus spoke to Dante in a low voice, but Dante said loudly,
"I will not say nothing. I will defend my church and my religion when it is insulted and spit on by renegade Catholics."
Mr. Casey pushed his plate rudely into the middle of the table and, resting his elbows before him, said in a hoarse voice to his host,
"Tell me, did I tell you that story about a very famous spit?"
"You did not, John," said Mr. Dedalus.
"Why then," said Mr. Casey, "it is a most instructive story. It happened not long ago in the County Wicklow, where we are now."
He broke off and, turning towards Dante, said with quiet indignation,
"And I may tell you, ma'am, that I, if you mean me, are no renegade Catholic. I am a Catholic as my father was, and his father before him, and his father before him again, when we gave up our lives rather than sell our faith."
"The more shame to you now," Dante said, "to speak as you do."
"The story, John," said Mr. Dedalus, smiling. "Let us have the story, anyhow."
"Catholic indeed," repeated Dante ironically. "The blackest Protestant in the land would not speak the language I have heard this evening."
Mr. Dedalus began to sway his head to and fro, crooning like a country singer.
"I am no Protestant, I tell you again," said Mr. Casey, flushing.
Mr. Dedalus, still crooning and swaying his head, began to sing in a grunting nasal tone,
"Oh, come all ye Roman Catholics that never went to mass."
He took up his knife and fork again in good humour and set to eating, saying to Mr. Casey,
"Let us have the story, John. It will help us to digest."
Stephen looked with affection at Mr. Casey's face, which stared across the table over his joined hands. He liked to sit near him at the fire, looking up at his dark, fierce face. But his dark eyes were never fierce, and his slow voice was good to listen to. But why was he then against the priests? Because Dante must be right then. But He had heard his father say that she was a spoiled nun and that she had come out of the convent in the Alleghenies when her brother had got the money from the savages for the trinkets and the chainies. Perhaps that made her severe against Parnell. And she did not like him to play with Eileen because Eileen was a Protestant, and when she was young she knew children that used to play with Protestants, and the Protestants used to make fun of the Litany of the Virgin Mary. Tower of Ivory, they used to say. House of Gold. How could a woman be a Tower of Ivory or a House of Gold? Who was right then? And he remembered the evening in the infirmary in Clongowes, the dark waters, the light at the pierhead, and the moan of sorrow from the people when they had heard. Eileen had long white hands. One evening when playing Tig, she had put her hands over his eyes, long and white and thin and cold and soft. That was ivory, a cold white thing. That was the meaning of Tower of Ivory. The story is very short and sweet, Mr. Casey said. It was one day down in Arklow, a cold, bitter day, not long before the chief died. May God have mercy on him. He closed his eyes wearily and paused. Mr. Dedalus took a bone from his plate and tore some meat from it with his teeth, saying, "Before he was killed, you mean?" Mr. Casey opened his eyes, sighed, and went on. "It was down in Arklow one day. We were down there at a meeting, and after the meeting was over, we had to make our way to the railway station through the crowd. Such booing and baaing, man, you never heard. They called us all the names in the world. Well, there was one old lady, and a drunken old harridan she was, surely, and that paid all her attention to me. She kept dancing along beside me in the mud, bawling and screaming into my face, 'Priest Hunter, the Paris Funds, Mr. Fox, Kitty O'Shea.'" "What did you do, John?" asked Mr. Douglas. "I let her bawl away," said Mr. Casey. "It was a cold day, and to keep up my heart, I had, saving your presence, ma'am, a quid of Tullamore in my mouth, and sure, I couldn't say a word in any case, because my mouth was full of tobacco juice."
"Well, John?"
"Well, I let her bawl away to her heart's content, Kitty O'Shea and the rest of it, until at last she called that lady a name that I won't sully this Christmas board, nor your ears, ma'am, nor my own lips by repeating."
He paused. Mr. Dedalus, lifting his head from the bone, asked, "And what did you do, John?"
"Do," said Mr. Casey. "She stuck her ugly old face up at me, and she said it, and I had my mouth full of tobacco juice. I bent down to her, and pfft, I says to her like that."
He turned aside and made the act of spitting.
"Says I to her like that, right into her eye."
He clapped a hand to his eye and gave a hoarse scream of pain.
"Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph," says she. I'm blinded and drowned."
He stopped in a fit of coughing and laughter, repeating,
"I'm blinded entirely."
Mr. Dedalus laughed loudly and lay back in his chair while Uncle Charles swayed his head to and fro. Dante looked terribly angry and repeated while they laughed, "Very nice, ha, very nice." It was not nice about the spit in the woman's eye, but what was a name the woman had called Kitty O'Shea that Mr. Casey would not repeat? He thought of Mr. Casey walking through the crowds of people and making speeches from a wagonette. That was what he had been in prison for, and he remembered that one night Sergeant O'Neill had come to the house and stood in the hall, talking in a low voice with his father and chewing nervously at the chin-strap of his cap. And that night Mr. Casey had not gone to Dublin by train, but a car had come to the door, and he had heard his father say something about the cab in Teely Road. He was for Ireland and Parnell, and so was his father, and so was Dante too, for one night at the band on the Esplanade when she had hit a gentleman on the head with her umbrella because he had taken off his hat when the band played God Save the Queen at the end. Mr. Dedalus gave a snort of contempt.
"Ah, John," he said, "it is true for them. We are an unfortunate priest-ridden race, and always were and always will be till the end of the chapter."
Uncle Charles shook his head, saying, "A bad business, a bad business." Mr. Dedalus repeated, "A priest-ridden, God-forsaken race." He pointed to the portrait of his grandfather on the wall to his right.
"Do you see that old chap up there, John?" he said. "He was a good Irishman when there was no money in the job. He was condemned to death as a white boy. But he had a saying about our clerical friends, that he would never let one of them put his 2 feet under his mahogany."
Dante broke in angrily.
"If we are a priest-ridden race, we ought to be proud of it. They are the apple of God's eye. Touch them not, says Christ, for they are the apple of my eye."
"And can we not love our country, then?" said Mr. Casey.
"Are we not to follow the man that was born to lead us?"
"A traitor to his country," replied Dante,
a traitor, an adulterer. The priests were right to abandon him. The priests were always the true friends of Ireland.
Were they, Faith? Said Mr. Casey. He threw his fist on the table and, frowning angrily, protruded one finger after another.
Didn't the bishops of Ireland betray us in the time of the Union when Bishop Lanigan presented an address of loyalty to the Marquess Cornwallis? Didn't the bishops and priests sell the aspirations of their country in 1829 in return for Catholic emancipation? Didn't they denounce the Fenian movement from the pulpit and in the confession box? And didn't they dishonour the ashes of Terence Bellew McManus?
His face was glowing with anger, and Stephen felt the glow rise to his own cheek as the spoken words thrilled him.
Mr. Dedalus uttered a guffaw of coarse scorn.
"Oh, by God!" he cried. "I forgot little old Paul Cullen, another apple of God's eye."
Dante bent across the table and cried to Mr. Casey,
"Right! Right! They were always right. God and morality and religion come first."
Mrs. Dedalus, seeing her excitement, said to her, "Mrs. Reardon, don't excite yourself answering them."
"God and religion before everything," Dante cried. "God and religion before the world."
Mr. Casey raised his clenched fist and brought it down on the table with a crash.
"Very well, then," he shouted hoarsely. "If it comes to that, no God for Ireland."
"John, John," cried Mr. Dedalus, seizing his guest by the coat sleeve. Dante stared across the table, her cheeks shaking. Mr. Casey struggled up from his chair and bent across the table toward her, scraping the air from before his eyes with one hand, as though he were tearing aside a cobweb.
"No God for Ireland," he cried. "We have had too much God in Ireland. Away with God."
"Blasphemer! Devil!"
screamed Dante, starting to her feet and almost spitting in his face. Uncle Charles and Mr. Dedalus pulled Mr. Casey back into his chair again, talking him from both sides reasonably. He stared before him out of his dark, flaming eyes, repeating, "Away with God, I say!" Dante shoved her chair violently aside and left the table, upsetting her napkin ring, which rolled slowly along the carpet and came to rest against the foot of an easy chair. Mrs. Dedalus rose quickly and followed her towards the door. At the door, Dante turned round violently and shouted from the room, her cheeks flushed and quivering with rage,
"Devil out of hell! We won! We crushed him to death! Fiend!"
The door slammed behind her.
Mr. Casey, freeing his arms from his holders, suddenly bowed his head on his hands with a sob of pain.
"Poor Parnell!" he cried loudly. "My dead king!"
He sobbed loudly and bitterly. Stephen, raising his terror-stricken face, saw that his father's eyes were full of tears.
The fellows talked together in little groups. One fellow said, "They were caught near the Hill of Leon."
"Who caught them?"
"Mr. Gleeson and the minister. They were on a car," the same fellow added. "A fellow in the higher line told me."
Fleming asked, "But why did they run away? Tell us."
"I know why," Cecil Tumbler said. "Because they had fecked cash out of the rector's room."
"Who fecked it?"
"Kickham's brother, and they all want shares in it."
"But that was stealing. How could they have done that?"
"A fat lot you know about it, Thunder," Wells said. "I know why they scut."
"Tell us why."
"I was told not to," Wells said.
"Oh, go on," Wells all said. "You might tell us. We won't let it out."
Stephen bent forward his head to hear. Wells looked round to see if anyone was coming. Then he said secretly,
"You know the altar wine they keep in the press in the sacristy?"
"Yes."
"Well, they drank that and it was found out who did it by the smell, and that's why they ran away, if you want to know."
And the fellow who had spoken first said,
"Yes, that's what I heard too from the fellow in the higher line."
The fellows were all silent. Stephen stood among them, afraid to speak, listening. A faint sickness of awe made him feel weak.
How could they have done that?
He thought of the dark, silent sacristy. There were dark wooden presses there where the crimped surplices lay quietly folded. It was not the chapel, but still you had to speak under your breath. It was a holy place. He remembered the summer evening he had been there to be dressed as a boat-bearer, the evening of the procession to the little altar in the wood. A strange and holy place. The boy that held the censer had swung it gently to and fro near the door with the silvery cap lifted by the middle chain to keep the coals lighting.
That was called charcoal, and it had burned quietly as the fellow had swung it gently and had given off a weak, sour smell. And then, when all were vested, he had stood holding out the boat to the rector, and the rector had put a spoonful of incense in it, and it had hissed on the red coals. The fellows were talking together in little groups here and there on the playground. The fellows seemed to him to have grown smaller. That was because a sprinter had knocked him down the day before, a fellow out of second of grammar. He had been thrown by the fellow's machine lightly on the cinder path, and his spectacles had been broken in three pieces, and some of the grit of the cinders had gone into his mouth. That was why the fellow seemed to him smaller and farther away, and the goalposts so thin and far, and the soft grey sky so high up. But there was no play in the football grounds, for cricket was coming, and some said that Barnes would be the prof, and some said it would be Flowers. And all over the playgrounds they were playing rounders and bowling twisters and lobs. And from here and from there came the sounds of the cricket bats through the soft grey air. They said pick, pack, pock, pock, like drops of water in a fountain slowly falling in the brimming bowl. Athy, who had been silent, said quietly, "You're all wrong." All turned towards him eagerly. "Why? Do you know? Who told you? Tell us, Athy." Athy pointed across the playground to where Simon Moonan was walking by himself, kicking a stone before him. "Ask him," he said. The fellows looked there and said, "Why him? Is he in it? Tell us, Athy. Go on, you might if you know." Athy lowered his voice and said, "Do you know why those fellows scut? I would tell you, but you must not let on you know." He paused for a moment and then said mysteriously, "They were caught with Simon Moonan and Tusker Boyle in the square one night." The fellows looked at him and asked, "Caught? What doing?" Athy said, "Smuggling." All the fellows were silent, and Athy said, "And that's why." Stephen looked at the faces of the fellows, but they were all looking across the playground. He wanted to ask somebody about it. What did that mean about the smuggling in the square? Why did the five fellows out of the higher line run away like that? It was a joke, he thought. Simon Moonan had nice clothes, and one night he had shown him a ball of creamy sweets that the fellows at the Football 15 had rolled down to him along the carpet in the middle of the refectory when he was at the door. It was the night of the match against the Bective Rangers, and the ball was made just like a red and green apple, only it opened and it was full of the creamy sweets. And one day Boyle had said that an elephant had two tuskers instead of two tusks, and that was why he was called Tusker Boyle. But some fellows called him Lady Boyle because he was always at his nails paring them. Eileen had long, thin, cool, white hands, too, because she was a girl. They were like ivory, only soft. That was the meaning of Tower of Ivory, but Protestants could not understand it and made fun of it. One day he had stood beside her looking into the hotel grounds. A waiter was running up a trail of bunting on the flagstaff, and a fox terrier was scampering to and fro on the sunny lawn. She had put her hand into his pocket, where his hand was, and he had felt how cool and thin and soft her hand was. She had said that pockets were funny things to have, and then all of a sudden she had broken away and had run laughing down the sloping curve of the path. Her fair hair had streamed out behind her like gold in the sun. Tower of Ivory, House of Gold. By thinking of things, you could understand them. But why in the square? You went there when you wanted to do something. It was all thick slabs of slate, and water trickled all day out of tiny pinholes, and there was a queer smell of stale water there. And behind the door of one of the closets, there was a drawing in red pencil of a bearded man in a Roman dress, with a brick in each hand, and underneath was the name of the drawing. Balbus was building a wall. Some fellows had drawn it there for a god. He had a funny face, but it was very like a man with a beard, and on the wall of another closet there was written in black hand in beautiful writing, "Julius Caesar wrote the Calico Belly." Perhaps that was why there was... Some fellows had drawn it there for a cod. It had a funny face, but it was very like a man with a beard, and on the wall of another closet there was written in black hand in beautiful writing, "Julius Caesar wrote the Calico Belly." Perhaps that was why they were there, because it was a place where some fellows wrote things for cod. But all the same, it was queer what Athy had said, and the way he had said it. It was not a cod, because they had run away. He looked with the others in silence across the playground and began to feel afraid. At last Fleming said,
"'And are we all to be punished for what other fellows did?'
"'I won't come back, see if I do,'
Cecil Thunder said. "'3 days silence in the refectory and sending us up for 6 and 8 every minute.'
"'Yes,' said Wells, "'and old Barrett has a new way of twisting the note "'so that you can't open it and fold it again "'to see how many furry lay you can get. "'I won't come back, too.'
"'Yes,' said Cecil Thunder.
"'And the Prefect of Studies was in second of grammar this morning?'
"'Let us get up a rebellion,' Fleming said. "'Will we?' All the fellows were silent. The air was very silent, and you could hear the cricket bats, but more slowly than before. Pick, puck. Wells asked, "'What's going to be done to them?'
"'Simon Moonan and Tusker are going to be flogged,' as I said, "'and the fellows in the higher line got their choice of flogging or being expelled.'
"'And which are they taking?' asked the fellow who had spoken first.
"'All are taking expulsion except Corrigan,' that I answered. "'He's going to be flogged by Mr. Gleeson.'
"'Is it Corrigan, that big fella?' said Fleming.
"'Why, he'd be able for two of Mr. Gleeson.'
"'I know why,' Cecil Thunder said.
"'He is right and the other fellows are wrong, "'because the flogging wears off after a bit, "'but a fellow that has been expelled from college "'is known all his life on account of it. "'Besides, Gleeson won't flog him hard.'
"'It's best of his play not to,' Fleming said.
"'I wouldn't like to be Simon Moonan and Tusker,' Cecil Thunder said. "'But I don't believe they will be flogged. "'Perhaps they will be sent up for 2x9.'
"'No, no,' said Athai. "'They'll both get it on the vital spot.'
"'Wells rubbed himself and said in a crying voice, "'Please, sir, let me off.'
"'Athai grinned and turned up the sleeves of his jacket, saying, "'It can't be helped. It must be done. "'Sit down with your breeches and out with your bum.' "'The fellows laughed, but he felt they were a little afraid.' In the silence of the soft grey air, he heard the cricket bats from here and from there. Puck. That was a sound to hear, but if you were hit, then you would feel a pain. The pandy bat made a sound too, but not like that. The fellows said it was made of whalebone and leather with lead inside. And he wondered, what was the pain like? There were different kinds of pains for all the different kinds of sounds. A long, thin cane would have a high, whistling sound, and he wondered what was the pain like. It made him shivery to think of it, and cold. And what Athai said, Sue. But what was there to laugh at in it? It made him shivery. But that was because you always felt like a shiver when you let down your trousers. It was like the same in a bath when you undressed yourself. He wondered who had let them down, the master or the boy himself. Oh, how could they laugh about it in that way? He looked at Athai's rolled up sleeves and knuckly, inky hands. He had rolled up his sleeves to show Mr. Gleeson to show how Mr. Gleeson would roll up his sleeves. But Mr. Gleeson had round, shiny cuffs, and clean white wrists and fattish white hands, and the nails of them were long and pointed. Perhaps he pared them too, like Lady Boyle. But they were terribly long and pointed nails, so long and cruel they were, though the white fascist hands were not cruel but gentle. And though he trembled with cold and fright to think of the cruel long nails and of the high whistling sound of the cane and of the chill you felt at the end of your shirt when you undressed yourself, yet he felt a feeling of queer quiet pleasure inside him to think of the white fattish hands, clean and strong and gentle. And he thought of what Cecil Thunder had said, that Mr. Gleeson would not flog Corrigan hard. And Fleming had said he would not because it was best of his play not to. But that was not why. A voice from far out on the playground cried, "All in!" And other voices cried, "All in! All in!" During the writing lesson, he sat with his arms folded, listening to the slow scraping of the pens. Mr. Harford went to and fro, making little signs in red pencil, and sometimes sitting beside the boy to show him how to hold the pen. He had tried to spell out the headline for himself, though he knew already what it was. Though he knew already what it was, for it was the last of the book. Zeal without prudence is like a ship adrift. But the lines of the letters were like fine invisible threads, and it was only by closing his right eye tight and staring out of his left eye that he could make out the full curves of the capital. But Mr. Hartford was very decent and never got into a wax. All the other masters got into dreadful waxes. But why were they to suffer for what fellows in the higher line did?
Wells had said that they had drunk some of the altar wine out of the press in the sacristy, and that it had been found out who had done it by the smell. Perhaps they had stolen a moonstrance to run away with it and sell it somewhere. That must have been a terrible sin, to go in there quietly at night, to open the dark press and steal the flashing gold thing into which God was put on the altar in the middle of the flowers and candles at benediction, while the incense went up in clouds on both sides as the fellow swung the censer and Dominic Kelly sang the first part by himself in the choir. But God was not in it, of course, when they stole it. But still it was a strange and a great sin even to touch it. He thought of it with deep awe, a terrible and strange sin. It thrilled him to think of it in the silence when the pens scraped lightly. But to drink the altar wine out of the press and to be found out by the smell was a sin too. But it was not terrible and strange. It only made you feel a little sickish on account of the smell of the wine. Because on the day when he had made his first Holy Communion in the chapel, he had shut his eyes and opened his mouth, put out his tongue a little, and when the rector had stooped down to give him the Holy Communion, he had smelt a faint, winey smell off the rector's breath after the wine of the Mass. The word was beautiful. Wine. It made you think of dark purple, because the grapes were dark purple that grew in Greece outside houses that look white temples. But the faint smell off the rector's breath had made him feel a sick feeling on the morning of his first communion. The day of your first communion was the happiest day of your life, and once a lot of generals had asked Napoleon what was the happiest day of his life. They thought he would say the day he won some great battle or the day he was made an emperor, but he said, "Gentlemen, the happiest day of my life was the day on which I made my first Holy Communion." Father Arnall came in and the Latin lesson began, and he remained still, leaning on the desk with his arms folded. Father Arnall gave out the theme books, and he said that they were scandalous and that they were all to be written out again with the corrections at once. But the worst of all was Fleming's theme, because the pages were stuck together by a blot, and Father Arnall held it up by a corner and said it was an insult to any master to send him such a theme. Then he asked Jack Lawton to decline the noun mare, and Jack Lawton stopped at the ablative singular and could not go on with the plural. "You should be ashamed of yourself," said Father Arnall sternly. "You, the leader of the class." Then he asked the next boy, and the next, and the next. Nobody knew. Father Arnall became very quiet, more and more quiet, as each boy tried to answer and could not. But his face was black-looking, and his eyes were staring, though his voice was so quiet. Then he asked Fleming, and Fleming said that the word had no plural. Father Arnall suddenly shut the book and shouted at him, "Kneel out there in the middle of the class. You are one of the idlest boys I ever met. Copy out your themes again, the rest of you." Fleming moved heavily out of his place and knelt between the last two benches. The other boys bent over their theme books and began to write. A silence filled the classroom, and Stephen, glancing timidly at Father Arnall's dark face, saw that it was a little red from the wax he was in. Was that a sin for Father Arnall to be in a wax, or was he allowed to get into a wax when the boys were idle because that made them study better, or was he only letting on to be in a wax? It was because he was allowed, because a priest would know what a sin was and would not do it. But if he did it one time by mistake, what would he do to go to confession? Perhaps he would go to confession to the minister. And if the minister did it, he would go to the rector, and if the rector to the provincial, and the provincial to the general of the Jesuits. That was called the order, and he has heard his father say they were all clever men. They could all have become high up people in the world if they had not become Jesuits. And he had wondered what Father Arnall and Paddy Barrett would have become, and what Mr. McGlade and Mr. Gleeson would have become if they had not become Jesuits. It was hard to think what, because you would have to think of them in a different way, with different coloured coats and trousers, and with beards and moustaches and different kind of hats. The door opened quietly and closed. A quick whisper ran through the class, the Prefect of Studies. There was an instant of dead silence, and then the loud crack of a pandybat on the last desk. Stephen's heart leapt up in fear. "Any boys want flogging here, Father Arnall?" cried the Prefect of Studies. "Any lazy, idle loafers that want flogging in this class?" He came to the middle of the class and saw Fleming on his knees. "Ho ho!" he cried. "Who is this boy? Why is he on his knees? What is your name, boy?"
"Fleming, sir."
"Ho ho, Fleming! An idler, of course. I can see it in your eye. Why is he on his knees, Father Arnall?"
"He wrote a bad Latin theme," Father Arnall said, "and he missed all the questions and grammar."
"Of course he did!"
cried the prefect of studies. "Of course he did, a born idler, I could see it in the corner of his eye."
He banged his pandybat up and down on the desk.
"Up, Fleming, up, me boy."
Fleming sat up slowly.
"Hold out,"
cried the prefect of studies. Fleming held out his hand. The pandybat came down in it with a loud smacking sound. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Other hand.
The pandybat came down again in 6 loud, quick smacks.
"Kneel down,"
cried the prefect of studies. Fleming knelt down, squeezing his hands under his armpits, his face contorted with pain. But Stephen knew how hard his hands were because Fleming was always rubbing rosin in them. But perhaps he was in great pain, for the noise of the pandies was terrible. Stephen's heart was beating and fluttering.
"At your work, all of you,"
shouted the prefect of studies.
"We want no lazy, idle loafers here, lazy, idle little schemers. At your work, I tell you. Father Dolan would be in to see you every day. Father Dolan would be in tomorrow."
He poked one of the boys in the side with the pandybat, saying,
"You boy, when will Father Dolan be in again?"
"Tomorrow, sir," said Tom Furlong's voice.
"Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow," said the prefect of studies. "Make up your minds for that. Every day, Father Dolan."
"Right away."
"You boy, who are you?"
Stephen's heart jumped suddenly.
"Dedalus, sir."
"Why are you not writing like the others?"
My...
He could not speak with fright.
"Why is he not writing, Father Arnall?"
"He broke his glasses," said Father Arnall, "and I exempted him from work."
"Broke? What's this I hear?"
"What is this your name is?" said the prefect of studies.
"Dedalus, sir."
"Out here, Dedalus. Lazy little schemer. I see schemer in your face. Where did you break your glasses?"
Stephen stumbled into the middle of the class, blinded by fear and haste.
"The cinder path, sir."
"Oh, the cinder path," cried the prefect of studies. "I know that trick."
Stephen lifted his eyes in wonder and saw for a moment Father Dolan's white-grey, not young face, his baldy white-grey head with fluff at the sides of it, the steel rims of his spectacles, and his non-coloured eyes looking through the glasses. Why did he say he knew that trick?
"Lazy, idle little loafer," cried the prefect of studies. "Broke my glasses, an old schoolboy trick. Out with your hand this moment."
Stephen closed his eyes and held out in the air his trembling hand with the palm upwards. He felt the prefect of studies touch it for a moment, at the fingers to straighten it, and then the swish of the sleeve of the soutane as the pandybat was lifted to strike. A hot, burning, stinging, tingling blow, like the loud crack of a broken stick, made his trembling hand crumple together like a leaf in the fire, and at the sound and the pain and scalding tears were driven into his eyes. His whole body was shaking with fright, his arm was shaking, and his crumpled, burning, livid hand shook like a loose leaf in the air. A cry sprang to his lips, a prayer to be let off. But though the tears scalded his eyes, and his limbs quivered with pain and fright, he held back the hot tears and the cry that scalded his throat.
"Other hand,"
shouted the prefect of studies. Stephen drew back his maimed and quivering right arm and held out his left hand. The soutane sleeve swished again as the pandybat was lifted, and a loud crashing sound and a fierce, maddening, tingling, burning pain made his hand shrink together with the palms and fingers in a livid, quivering mass. The scalding water burst forth from his eyes, and burning with shame and agony and fear, he drew back his shaking arm in terror and burst out into a whine of pain. His body shook with a palsy of fright, and in shame and rage he felt the scalding cry come from his throat and the scalding tears falling out of his eyes and down his flaming cheeks.
"Kneel down,"
cried the prefect of studies. Stephen knelt down, quickly pressing his beaten hands to his sides. To think of them beaten and swollen with pain all in a moment made him feel so sorry for them, as if they were not his own but someone else's that he felt sorry for. And as he knelt, calming the last sobs in his throat and feeling the burning, tingling pain pressing into his sides, he thought of the hands which he had held out in the air with the palms up, and of the firm touch of the prefect of studies when he had steadied the shaking fingers, and of the beaten, swollen, reddened mass of palm and fingers that shook helplessly in the air.
"Get at your work, all of you," cried the prefect of studies from the door. "Father Dolan would be in every day to see if any boy, any lazy, idle little loafer wants flogging. Every day, every day."
The door closed behind him. The hushed class continued to copy out the themes.
Father Arnall rose from his seat and went among them, helping the boys with gentle words and telling them the mistakes he had made. They had made. His voice was very gentle and soft. Then he returned to his seat and said to Fleming and Stephen, "You may return to your places, you two." Fleming and Stephen rose and, walking to their seats, sat down. Stephen, scarlet with shame, opened a book quickly with one weak hand and bent down upon it, his face close to the page. It was unfair and cruel because the doctor had told him not to read without glasses, and he had written home to his father that morning to send him a new pair. And Father Arnall had said that he need not study till the new glasses came. Then to be called a schemer before the class and to be pandied when he always got the card for first or second and was the leader of the Yorkists? How could the Prefect of Studies know that it was a trick? He felt the touch of the Prefect's fingers as they had steadied his hand, and at first he had thought he was going to shake hands with him because his fingers were soft and firm, but then in an instant he had heard the swish of the soutane sleeve and the crash. It was cruel and unfair to make him kneel in the middle of the class then, and Father Arnall had told them both that they might return to their places without making any difference between them. He listened to Father Arnall's low and gentle voice as he corrected the themes. Perhaps he was sorry now and wanted to be decent, but it was unfair and cruel. The Prefect of Studies was a priest. But that was cruel and unfair, and his white grey face and the non-coloured eyes behind the steel-rimmed spectacles were cruel-looking because he had steadied the hand first with his firm, soft fingers, and that was to hit it better and louder. "It's a stinking mean thing, that's what it is," said Fleming in the corridor as the classes were passing out in file to the refectory, "to pandy a fellow for what is not his fault." "You really broke your glasses by accident, didn't you?" Nasty Roach asked. Stephen felt his heart filled by Fleming's words and did not answer. "Of course he did," cried Fleming. "I wouldn't stand it. I'd go and tell the rector on him." "Yes," said Cecil Thunder eagerly. "I saw him lift the pandy bat over his shoulder, and he's not allowed to do that." "Did they hurt much?" Nasty Roach asked. "Very much," Stephen said. "I wouldn't stand it," Fleming repeated. "From Baldyhead or any other Baldyhead is a stinking mean low trick, that's what it is. I'd go straight up to the rector and tell him about it after dinner." "Yes, do, yes, do," said Cecil Thunder. "Yes, do. Yes, go and tell the rector on him, Dedalus," said Nasty Roach, "because he said that he'd come in tomorrow again to pandy you." "Yes, yes, tell the rector," all said. And there were some fellows out of second of grammar listening, and one of them said, "The Senate and the Roman people declared that Dedalus had been wrongly punished." It was wrong, it was unfair and cruel, and as he sat in the refectory, he suffered time after time in memory the same humiliation until he began to wonder whether it might not really be like that. There was something in his face which made him look like a schemer, and he wished he had a little mirror to see, but there could not be, and it was unjust and cruel and unfair. He could not eat the blackish fish fritters they got on Wednesdays in Lent, and one of his potatoes had the mark of the spade in it. Yes. He would do what the fellows had told him. He would go and tell the rector that he had been wrongly punished. A thing like that had been done before by somebody in history, by some great person whose head was in the books of history. And the rector would declare that he had been wrongly punished because the Senate and the Roman people always declared that the men who did that had been wrongly punished. Those were the great men whose names were in Richmal Magnall's Questions. History was all about those men and what they did, and that was what Peter Barley's tales about Greece and Rome were all about. Peter Barley himself was on the front page in a picture. There was a road over a heath with grass at the side and little bushes, and Peter Barley had a broad hat like a Protestant minister and a big stick, and he was walking fast along the road to Greece and Rome. It was easy what he had to do. All he had to do was when the dinner was over and he came out in his turn to go on walking, but not out to the corridor, but up the staircase on the right that led to the castle. He had nothing to do but that, to turn to the right and walk fast up the staircase, and in half a minute he would be in the low, dark, narrow corridor that led through the castle to the rector's room. And every fellow had said that it was unfair, even the fellow out of second grammar who had said that about the Senate and the Roman people. What would happen? He heard the fellows of the higher line stand up at the top of the refectory, and heard their steps as they came down the matting. Paddy Rath and Jimmy McGee and the Spaniard and the Portuguese, and the fifth was Big Corrigan, who was going to be flogged by Mr. Gleason. That was why the Prefect of Studies had called him a schemer and pandied him for nothing, and, straining his weak eyes, tired with the tears, he watched Big Corrigan's broad shoulders and big hanging back, black head passing in the file. But he had done something, and besides, Mr. Gleeson would not flog him hard, and he had remembered how big Corrigan had looked in the bath. He had skin the same colour as the turf-coloured bog water at the shallow end of the bath, and when he walked along the side his feet slapped loudly on the wet tiles, and at every step his thighs shook a little because he was fat. The refectory was half empty, and the fellows were still passing out in file. He could go up the staircase, because there was never a priest or a prefect outside the refectory door. But he could not go. The rector would side with the prefect of studies and think it was a schoolboy trick, and then the prefect of studies would come in every day the same, only it would be worse, because he would be dreadfully waxy at any fellow going up to the rector about him. The fellows had told him to go, but they would not go themselves. They had forgotten all about it. No, it was best to forget all about it, and perhaps the prefect of studies had only said he would come in. No, it was best to hide out of the way, because when you were small and young you could often escape that way. The fellows at his table stood up. He stood up and passed out among them in the file. He had to decide. He was coming near the door. If he went on with the fellows, he would never go up to the rector, because he could not leave the playground for that. And if he went and was pandied all the same, all the fellows would make fun and talk about young Dedalus going up to the rector to tell on the prefect of studies. He was walking down the matting, and he saw the door before him. It was impossible. He could not. He thought of the baldy head of the prefect of studies with the cruel no-coloured eyes looking at him, and he heard the voice of the prefect of studies asking him twice what his name was. Why could he not remember the name when he was told the first time? Was he not listening the first time, or was it to make fun out of the name? The great men in the history had names like that, and nobody made fun of them. It was his own name that he should have made fun of if he wanted to make fun. Dolan. It was like the name of the woman who washed clothes. He'd reached the door, and, turning quickly up to the right, walked up the stairs, and before he could make up his mind to come back, he had entered the low, dark, narrow corridor that led to the castle. And as he crossed the threshold of the door of the corridor, he saw, without turning his head to look, that all the fellows were looking after him as they went filing by. He passed along the narrow, dark corridor, passing little doors that were the doors of the rooms of the community. He peered in front of him, and right and left, through the gloom, and thought that those must be portraits. It was dark and silent, and his eyes were weak and tired with tears so that he could not see. But he thought they were the portraits of the saints and great men of the order who were looking down on him silently as he passed. St. Ignatius Loyola, holding an open book and pointing to the words Ad Majorem Dei Gloriam in it, and Francis Xavier pointing to his chest. Lorenzo Ricci with his beretta on his head like one of the prefects of the lines, and the three patron saints of holy youth, St. Stanislaus Kostka, St. Aloysius Gonzaga, and Blessed John Birchmans. All the young faces, because they died when they were young. And Father Peter Kenny sitting in a chair wrapped in a big cloak. He came out on the landing above the entrance hall and looked about him. That was where Hamilton Rowan had passed, and the marks of the soldiers' slugs were there. And it was there the old servants had seen the ghost in the white cloak of a marshal. An old servant was sweeping at the end of the landing. He asked him where the rector's room, and the old servant pointed to the door at the far end and looked after him as he went on and knocked. There was no answer. He knocked again more loudly, and his heart jumped when he heard a muffled voice say, "Come in." He turned the handle and opened the door, and fumbled for the handle of the green baize door inside. He found it and pushed it open and went in. He saw the rector sitting at a desk writing. There was a skull on the desk and a strange, solemn smell in the room like the old leather of chairs. His heart was beating fast on account of the solemn place he was in and the silence of the room, and he looked at the skull and at the rector's kind-looking face. "Well, my little man," said the rector, "what is it?" Stephen swallowed down the thing in his throat and said, "I broke my glasses, sir." The rector opened his mouth and said, "Oh." Then he smiled and said, "Well, if we broke our glasses, we must write home for a new pair." "I wrote home, sir," said Stephen, "and Father Arnall said I'm not to study till they come." "Quite right," said the rector. Stephen swallowed down the thing again and tried to keep his legs and his voice from shaking. "But, sir..." "Yes?" "Father Dolan came in to say... Father Dolan came in today and pandied me because I was not writing my theme."
The rector looked at him in silence, and he could feel the blood rising to his face and the tears about to rise to his eyes. The rector said, "Your name is Dedalus, isn't it?"
"Yes, sir."
"And where did you break your glasses?"
"On the cinder path, sir. A fellow was coming out of the bicycle house and I fell and they got broken. I don't know the fellow's name."
The rector looked at him again in silence. Then he smiled and said,
"Oh, well, it was a mistake. I'm sure Father Dolan did not know."
"But I told him I broke them, sir, and he pandied me."
"Did you tell him that you had written home for a new pair?"
the rector asked.
"No, sir."
"Oh, well then," said the rector.
Father Dolan did not understand. You can say that I excused you from your lessons for a few days."
Stephen said quickly, for fear his trembling would prevent him,
"Yes, sir, but Father Dolan said he will come in tomorrow and pandy me again for it."
"Very well," the rector said. "It is a mistake, and I shall speak to Father Dolan myself. Will that do now?" Stephen felt the tears wetting his eyes and murmured, "Oh, yes, sir, thanks."
The rector held his hand across the side of the desk where the skull was, and Stephen, placing his hand in it for a moment, felt a cool, moist palm.
"Good day now," said the rector, withdrawing his hand and bowing.
"Good day, sir," said Stephen.
He bowed and walked quietly out of the room, closing the doors carefully and slowly. But when he had passed the old servant on the landing and was again in the low, narrow, dark corridor, he began to walk faster and faster. Faster and faster he hurried on through the gloom excitedly. He bumped his elbow against the door at the end and, hurrying down the staircase, walked quickly through the two corridors and out into the air. He could hear the cries of the fellows in the playgrounds. He broke into a run and, running quicker and quicker, ran across the cinder path. And reached the third-lined playground panting. The fellows had seen him running. They closed round him in a ring, pushing one against the other to hear.
"Tell us, tell us. What did he say? Did you go in? What did he say? Tell us."
He told them what he had said and what the rector had said, and when he had told them, all the fellows flung their caps spinning up into the air and cried, "Hurroo!" They caught their caps and sent them up again, spinning sky high, and cried again, "Hurroo! Hurroo!" They made a cradle of their locked hands and hoisted him up among them and carried him along till he struggled to get free. And when he had escaped from them, they broke away in all directions, flinging their caps again into the air and whistling as they went spinning up and crying, "Hurroo!" And they gave three groans for Baldy Head Dolan and three cheers for Conmee. And then they said he was the decentest rector that ever was in Clungoes. The cheers died away in the soft grey air. He was alone. He was happy and free. But he would not be any way proud with Father Dolan. He would be very quiet and obedient. And he wished that he could do something kind for him to show him that he was not proud. The air was soft and grey and mild, and evening was coming. There was the smell of evening in the air. The smell of the fields and the country where they digged up turnips to peel them and eat them when they went out for a walk to Major Barton's. The smell there was in the little wood beyond the pavilion where the gallnuts were. The fellows were practicing long shies and bowing lobs and slow twisters. In the soft grey silence he could hear the bump of the balls, and from here and from there through the quiet air the sound of the cricket bats. Like drops of water in a fountain falling softly in the brimming bowl. End of chapter 1.